Vince, I was on a first-name basis with him, as I guess adversaries must be, was a master orator, and this was one of his trademark perorations. Our interview that day dragged on for more than 6 hours, and he did most of the talking, holding forth as expertly as he had when he prosecuted the Charles Manson trial more than 35 years before. 71 and in shirt sleeves, Vince still cut an imposing figure, hectoring me over a formica table strewn with legal pads, notes, tape recorders, pens, and a stack of books, all written by him. Wiry and spry, his eyes a steely blue, he would sit down only to leap up again and point his finger in my face. Riffling through the pages of one of his yellow legal pads, he read from some remarks he'd prepared. "I'm a decent guy, Tom, and I'm going to educate you a little about just how decent Vince Bugliosi is." And so he did, reciting a pre-written opening statement that lasted for 45 minutes. He insisted on beginning this way. He'd dragooned his wife Gail into serving as a witness for the proceedings, just in case I'd try to misrepresent him. Essentially, he turned his kitchen into a courtroom. And in a courtroom, he was in his element. Bugliosi had made his name with the Manson trial, captivating the nation with stories of murderous hippies, brainwashing, race wars, and lurid acid trips gone awry. Vince was sure to remind me, early and often, that he'd written 3 best-selling books, including Helter Skelter, his account of the Manson murders and their aftermath, which became the most popular true crime book ever. If he seemed a little keyed up that day, well, so was I. My task was to press him on some of his conduct in the Manson trial. There are big holes in Helter Skelter. Contradictions, omissions, discrepancies with police reports. The book amounts to an official narrative that few have ever thought to question. But I'd found troves of documents, many of them unexamined for decades and never before reported on, that entangled Vince and a host of other major players, like Manson's parole officer, his friends in Hollywood, the cops and lawyers and researchers and medical professionals surrounding him. Among many other things, I had evidence in Vince's own handwriting that one of his lead witnesses had lied under oath. I sometimes wonder if Vince could see what a bundle of nerves I was that day. I'm not a church-going person, but I'd gone to church that morning and said a little prayer. My mom always told me I should pray when I need help, and that day I needed all the help I could get. I hoped that my interview with Vince would mark a turning point in my 7 years of intensive reporting on the Manson murders. I'd interviewed more than 1,000 people by then. My work had left me, at various points, broke, depressed, and terrified that I was becoming one of those people. An obsessive, a conspiracy theorist, a lunatic. I'd let friendships fall away. My family had worried about my sanity. Manson himself had harangued me from prison. I'd faced multiple threats on my life. I don't consider myself a credulous man, but I'd discovered things I thought impossible about the Manson murders and California in the 60s. Things that reek of duplicity and cover-up, implicating police departments up and down the state. Plus the courts. Plus, though I have to take a deep breath before I let myself say it, the CIA. If I could get Bugliosi to admit any wrongdoing, or even to let a stray detail slip, I could finally start to unravel dozens of the other strands of my reporting. Maybe soon I could get my life back, whatever that might look like. At the very least, I could know that I'd done all I could to get to the bottom of this seemingly endless hole. Sitting in his kitchen, though, and watching the hours wear on as Vince defended and fortified every point he made, my heart sank. He was stonewalling me.